Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, healthy living. With the holidays behind us and the start of a new year, many resolve to make diet and lifestyle changes. Perhaps it's starting a fitness regime or abstaining from alcohol for the month. Others endeavor to lose weight. Not only is it important to follow healthy nutrition programs, it's also sticking with the changes that will make a difference long term. Dr. Kumara Siddhartha has long pointed to research evidence that adopting a plant-based diet can help prevent and manage chronic disease, achieve safe weight loss, and save us money. In addition to being the Chief Health Equity and Wellness Officer at Cape Cod Healthcare, he's the author of All My Secrets, Uncovering Messages of Health from Your Body. The book has been re-released with updated information. Dr. Sid, welcome back. Always good to have you here.
Good morning, Mindy. Happy to be here. Thank you.
All right. So let's start with some research that came out last year after your book was published. It has to do with lifestyle changes, including diet and the progression of dementia. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it was coming at the heel of other research that has been done looking at lifestyle changes and dementia, Alzheimer's dementia, and other dementia coming from other reasons as well that can happen due to arteries getting clogged, all right? So, and the way it has been looked at in the past is using diet, using exercise, and meditation or mindfulness, and other elements such as group support. This particular study that was published in June of 24 is a breakthrough in research, because it looked at can lifestyle changes not only prevent dementia, but can it actually reverse it after dementia has been diagnosed? And this is groundbreaking in that sense, that after decades of looking for a magic bullet, which usually happens to be very expensive solutions, mm-hmm. In this case, something that is right within the reach of every individual, using changes in different aspects of the lifestyle, how it can reverse dementia. It was done in patients who have early dementia, like in the early stages. So that's probably the best time to capture it. At least the study looked at individuals who had early dementia. So pretty fascinating study.
I think mind-blowing. It's like, people go, did I hear that right? Yes. So what are your thoughts on why plant-based diets and these other lifestyle changes can not only reduce the progression of dementia, but can prevent it? What's going on in our bodies? How is that? How does that happen?
Yeah. So there are three main things we can talk about. But before we go there, I want to say that there is a concept called neuroplasticity, which has changed the way we looked at how nerve cells can recover and regenerate. In 20 years ago, we always thought that when there is a stroke and there's a damage to a nerve cell in the brain, then it's done. It's mm-hmm. cooked. It can never recover. And the idea and the concept of neuroplasticity has shown how there is a potential for nerve cells to regenerate, right? So in dementia, there are a few key changes that happens in the brain. It involves inflammation. It involves changes in how blood sugar balance is controlled in and around the nerve cell by the amount of insulin, which would, for listeners, it will sound like, are we talking about diabetes here? It's fascinating. Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the scientists call Alzheimer's dementia as type 3 diabetes.
Wow.
It's not a well-known name out there, but in the scientific circles, there are research looking at, if there is so much similarity between what happens in diabetes in the body and what happens in dementia being similar, then, can this be called type 3 diabetes? That's kind of the argument there. So balance of blood sugar, amount of inflammation is kind of two things to think about in how nerve cells can be damaged. Mm-hmm. And it leads to other changes that starts to, we have some plaques that settle in the cells, and that slowly develops into dementia. But those are one element of Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
The vascular dementia, what is called as vascular, which is where the blood circulation gets blocked, and that leads to dementia. That's also impacted and assisted by these type of dietary changes and other lifestyle changes.
Yeah. Inflammation. I mean, that is such a key, not only to Alzheimer's, but so many things. Inflammation's not good, right?
Correct.
We want to try to keep the inflammation down as much as possible. And I don't think people realize how much there are certain foods that really increase inflammation. One is chicken, right? I mean, who would have thought there's something in chicken that...
So there are three ways inflammatory status goes up in the body in different organs and overall. One is arachidonic acid, the amount of arachidonic acid that gets into our system and generally through food, and it can be, even poultry, eggs, not only red meat. These things can also introduce more of this arachidonic acid raw material into the body, which can be broken down by the body, and some of that leads to inflammatory molecules. You know, if we think about people taking anti-inflammatory, like ibuprofen and things like that over the counter, those medications actually block this arachidonic acid pathway, right? So we know that how arachidonic acid works to increase inflammation. So that's one way, you know, food can impact. The other way food can impact is, you know, excess calories, just excess calories leading to excess buildup of fat, especially deep inside the abdomen, called visceral fat or abdominal fat. That becomes like a factory of inflammation, right? Mm-hmm. It puts out so much inflammation. And the third reason why inflammation happens is what happens in the gut lining, how healthy the lining of the gut is. And if that lining of the gut is not healthy with enough, having enough dietary fiber that comes from fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains, the fiber is not there. And if there's, you know, processed foods coming in, then that leads to damage to the lining of the gut, which leads to something called endotoxemia, which releases a lot of inflammation. So those are three ways that can affect inflammation.
We're going to get to the food part, but I want to go to the Surgeon General just issued an advisory on the links between alcohol and cancer. I imagine that was not a surprise to you. No. What do you tell patients about alcohol consumption and health?
Yes. So in general, for cultural, social reasons, if it is infrequent, I think alcohol is safe to that degree. And especially at a younger age. As somebody gets into older age and their body systems are changing, they have not supported the body along the way with good nutrition, for example, then the alcohol, whatever level that is, becomes too much and excessive and toxic. It can affect different systems. We knew about the cancer link for more than a decade now, the association between alcohol and cancer. But there is also other areas that it can impact, including the nerves, that can cause neuropathy, and other areas, including effects on the gut.
Yeah. Is it partly when you say when you're aging, is it just like your metabolism changing and other things happening in your body?
What I meant. When I say aging, I think folks may think like a number of years, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about the number of birthdays you went through. It's more about how much the body physiology has changed or degenerated. So you could be your biological age. Somebody could be 40. But if they're not taking care of themselves, their internal system could be like they're 60, right? Or the reverse is possible too, right?
Yeah.
When you do the right thing.
Yeah. I was reading an article, I think it was a neurologist who suggested if you're over the age of 65, you should cut out alcohol altogether. And what surprised me, and there was a lot of like common sense reasons, but the number one reason he listed was falling. And I thought, wow, that makes a lot of sense because the older you are, you got to be careful once you start falling, right? I mean, that leads down a bad path.
Yeah, fall is a huge risk for many things, including just leading to death from the complications related to that. Fall risk, anything we can do to prevent it is going to be a good thing. And one of the elements that can impact that is alcohol, not only the fact that alcohol could influence, the awareness levels, and we can be impacted immediately, the immediate effect of falling down. But also long term, it can start to affect the nerves in the feet, called neuropathy, and that can also be a way it increases the risk of fall.
Mm-hmm. So even if you're getting older and you're not somebody who's consuming alcohol, balance is key. So when we talk about exercise, balance exercises, especially as you get older, become really important.
Correct. There are a couple of things in that. One is, yes, I think balance is important. When we start to unpack it, you know, we also need to make sure that there is the person has a good core strength. Mm-hmm. So the strength training for major muscles of the abdomen, thighs and glutes, those become important to prevent fall. And also the ability to, there's a term called proprioception, which is how our feet can sense where we are standing, what kind of a platform or a surface we are standing, and send that signal to the brain to know where we are. And those things are improved by balanced training, whether it is things like yoga or Tai Chi, that improves that sensors in the feet.
Yeah. Many people abstain from alcohol this month. It's referred to as Dry January. If people are hoping to make lifestyle changes, is it wise to tackle fitness, diets, and abstinence all at once, or is it better to focus on one at a time?
When folks do it all at once, then the benefits are multiplied. Depending upon the bandwidth for the person to consider such changes, they could layer it or stagger it one after the other, but continue to layer it, right? Mm-hmm. So in other words, if somebody says, oh, I can't start all three, you know, I can do only like diet first, or I can do only like mindfulness first or exercise first. Yes, start that. But then when you add, and it's best to add the next lifestyle change rather than, mm-hmm. you know, replacing
right.
what has been already
yeah.
started.
What do you think about Dry January? So folks, you know, they decide they're not going to drink alcohol for the month of January. Will you notice enough changes in your body in that month to go, wait, maybe I should do this all the time? Or, I mean, how much benefit is there, I guess, of going a month without alcohol?
I mean, if there are some immediate effects, short-term effects, that would be beneficial. But the key question really here is that going without alcohol for a month, what does that do to long-term in terms of how much the person has control over the alcohol as opposed to the other way around?
We're talking with Dr. Kumara Siddhartha. His book is All My Secrets, Uncovering Messages of Health from Your Body. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Kumara Siddhartha, who has long pointed to research that adopting a plant-based diet can help prevent and manage chronic disease and achieve safe weight loss. He is the author of All My Secrets, Uncovering Messages of Health from Your Body. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before I get into some of the messages you have in the book, I want to go back to that study about the dementia and how we can, through changes in lifestyle and diet, we can not only reduce our risk of dementia, but we can also prevent it. A lot of people are going, wait a minute, what about genetics? You know, I have, you know, there's talk, people talk about that genetic connection to Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. What did this study or research tell us about that?
Yes. So not only this study, but the other studies that came before that has shown that lifestyle can trump genetics with regard to risks of dementia, cancer, and other diseases, heart disease, cholesterol, high blood pressure, and so forth. So there are studies, different countries have done different, you know, studies looking at this gene and effect on dementia. The Swedish Twin Registry is a cohort of patients they've been following for many decades in Sweden, looking at twins and identical twins, so same gene pattern, both of them, but different outcomes, right? Mm. And it's usually the lifestyle. So they found that, again there, that the dementia risk is not the same among the twins based on their lifestyle, especially, you know, fruits and vegetables, consumption of legumes, consumption of healthy nuts like walnuts that has omega-3 and so forth, that it changes the outcome regardless of the genes.
Yeah. Some diseases, as we've said, have genetic links, but you've said that even if you have a gene that predisposes you to a disease, changes in lifestyle can turn on and off the gene. Explain how that works. That just is mind-blowing. How does that work?
Yes. The technical lingo is genetic expression, but simply we can say the genes can be turned off or turned on, right? So not all genes, if they get transferred to the next generation, gets activated to actually manifest as a disease. That it needs to happen, it needs to have the right conditions for the gene to start to get activated. So as long as we, if there is a gene for a higher risk for certain diseases is transferred, and they have a family history, for example, doing the right things with lifestyle, making sure that there are fruits and vegetables, then legumes and whole grains, and those kind of effects can turn off genes for cancer, for dementia, and so forth.
Which would explain sometimes, you know, you have a family and you think all of these, you know, family who've got certain types of cancer and one or two did not. You're like, what's the difference, right?
Yes,
and
yeah.
This is it.
Yeah, and so there are very rare scenarios, like maybe less than 10% of breast cancer, for example, right? They are strongly genetically mm-hmm. linked, and there, you know, food may not be able to trump it.
Right.
But for the most part, 90% of the breast cancers are related not to the core yeah. genetic tendencies. And so the gene piece, and the field is epigenetics that has been flourishing in the past 2-3 decades to understand the things that can overcome genetic effects.
Amazing. All right, we have a listener question. It says, my wife and I do a strictly vegan diet every other month. During the non-vegan months, we enjoy dairy, mostly cheese, with the occasional beef and chicken. What is your opinion of an every other month vegan routine?
That's based, I mean, I don't know if that is a particular study done in that kind of a staggered pattern. However, I would recommend you to pay attention to what the body is telling you during the months when, you know, when you're on a complete vegan diet and during the months when you're not. And it looks like, you know, if there is just some dairy a little bit introduced, you know, depending upon the amount that goes into the system, you know, it could be undermining the other good things that are happening, you know, in that month.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know the amount and the portion size of the dairy going in. But, yeah. Generally, I think, having enough fruits and vegetables, legumes, all of that is a good thing throughout the year. And so I would recommend just paying attention to what the body is telling you.
The number of people with chronic disease is rapidly increasing, and it's estimated that nearly 164 million Americans, nearly half the population, will be diagnosed with a chronic condition in 2025. The good news is that these diseases are often, as you're saying, preventable and can be managed through early detection, improved diet, and exercise. So let's talk about the components to a whole health approach to treatment and care. You go through a lot of this in the book. You have these conversations with 9 people and their bodies, fictional yet based in fact. So the people are kind of fictional. So why did you choose that format?
Well, the format, one of the main reasons, I think, is because I don't like to be told what to do. And I'm sure many who are listening also don't like to be told what to do. So this format allows me to present the information in a way where the reader of the book is just watching a conversation happening between the character and the character's own body in a kind of a meditative trance moment. There's an inner conversation for each of those 9 characters in the book. They're just observing a dialogue and picking up some points from there rather than somebody, the author, me, telling, you know, do this and don't do this and things like that.
It's an interesting way, too, because there's a lot of science in these conversations. So you're learning a lot as well as, kind of what...
That's the idea. It's an education.
And the whole thing, and I think one of the messages, correct me if I'm wrong, is here, listen to your body. Is that what you're trying to say?
That is the main theme undercurrent throughout these characters, all the nine characters, is to pay attention to the body. Body is trying to send signals. It's like, as one of my friends says, it's like notifications that like you get in your app, like there's a ping, there's a notification comes up, right? Body is always trying to send notifications, right? The notifications are always there if we pay attention, like in our phone apps, you know, it pops up and you see it. But if we pay attention to the body, we will hear it. We will hear those notifications and signals. If not, then they get louder and louder. And louder.
Listen to me.
And then that louder forms can be in the form of a screening test, or a mammogram coming positive, or a colonoscopy coming positive, or even a cholesterol level in your blood test coming positive. That's happening at a later stage in a more louder version of the signal.
Right. All right. So you recommend a plant-based diet and make a conscious choice to use the term plant-based diet instead of vegetarian or vegan. I think last time I asked you this, you said, well, Oreos are vegan, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think I think I just want to make sure that whatever I say and whatever is shared in the book is just truly representing what the data shows. And the data is on whole food plant-based diets. That's what works. That when we say whole food, it makes sure that it is it's not processed and it's wholesome. And when it's plant-based, it's coming out of a plant origin. So, you know, like from fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains and nuts and seeds, right? That's the package. So, a vegan diet, as I said, it could be not necessarily healthy if it is a processed vegan item. Like French fries is vegan too, right? So, you know, those kind of things are processed and fried. And so that's why this terminology becomes a better representation of what we're talking about.
Right. All right, so not processed. Boy, that's hard, huh? I mean, there's so much, when you go into the grocery store, so much processed food. So you're looking at what you want us to be in, like, the produce section, right? And really looking at labels.
Correct, yes. Yeah. So, you know, when I think if you're buying most of your cart that you're pushing around in the grocery store, didn't need a package around it. That's a good start. And but if there is a label on it, if there is a package, a label on it, less number of ingredients listed is a better start in that way. And again, always look for fiber. You know, if the amount of fiber in the nutrition label is zero or minimal, then that is not the ideal way to go. Generally, there is a way to look at it is just make sure that whatever carbohydrate is listed in the nutrition label, that the fiber is at least more than a 10% of that, so more than 1/10 of the carbohydrate.
All right, sugar. We look at the labels. I mean, I guess sodium too. You look at the labels and sometimes you're like, whoa, I had no idea. Like, you know, I have a 9-year-old at home and, you know, the kids, they're very picky. And I try to, anything I buy for him, I try to make sure it's got like 10% or less of sugar. But some of those drinks, you'll be like 28%, 32%. Like you can't. And then like the different terminology, the different names we have for sugar. Sometimes you don't realize when you look, because there's all these like sort of chemical names. So I guess the more chemical names, the less you'd want to be purchasing that?
Definitely. Yeah. That's a very intuitively, you need to stay away from that as much as possible. But also one of the things, universally, all the manufacturers of food follow a rule, which is the order in which the ingredients are listed goes by decreasing order of weight contributing to the whole packet. So in other words, if sugar is listed as number one, which
it's
means
sugar,
then it is mostly sugar contributing to the weight of the packet, weight of the product. So, you know, where the sugar is listed in that order of ingredient list is also matters. So if it is way down on the bottom, then we know that it's not contributing to most of the weight of the product.
Yeah. In the past, the Mediterranean diet was touted as reducing heart disease and other chronic disease. How does it differ from a plant-based diet, and are the health benefits similar? We hear a lot of people going, I'm going to go with the Mediterranean diet.
Yes. So the studies in the past that had shown, compared to average standard American diet, that there was a difference in terms of reducing the risk of stroke, especially. The way I describe that is usually the difference. First of all, let me talk about the difference. So in Mediterranean diet, you know, it varies depending upon the type of the country we're talking about, whether it's Greece or Sardinia. Different countries have slightly different variations in the composition of the Mediterranean diet. But in general, we know that they have a high proportion of fruits and vegetables. They have legumes. They rarely use red meat. If there is chicken, Sardinia and places like that, poultry is once a week. I think they use chickpeas more. Yogurt is usually not part of the diet, generally in Mediterranean diet. So there are some elements that could change, but generally heavily fruits and vegetables. There are nuts involved and things like that. In a whole food plant-based diet, the food is coming from five food groups, right? Leafy greens and vegetables as one group on the top, most of the volume coming from that. Legumes, fruits, whole grains, and a smaller portion of nuts and seeds, right? Because they're very calorically dense. So that's kind of the difference between how the makeup is mm-hmm. between Mediterranean and whole food plant-based. With regard to benefits, the simplest way I describe it is, you know, it depends upon how the studies were done looking at Mediterranean diet and what they were comparing with when they were seeing the benefit of the Mediterranean diet. So mm-hmm. they were comparing with the standard diet, which leads to all the diseases that we're seeing right now. So one way to look at it is, it's like comparing in the school, in a classroom, a B student with a D student. Mm-hmm. And D being the standard American diet and B being the Mediterranean diet, the B student, it is always going to look better.
Right.
So, yeah. But the idea is...
You've got to compare it to the A. Comparing it to a plant-based diet. But, this isn't an easy transition, right? So, in fact, you say it can be 6 weeks to 6 months for your taste buds to adapt. So this transition can be tough. So in some ways, maybe... If this is too much for you to take on, as you're saying, maybe a little bit at a time, maybe going to a Mediterranean diet and then transitioning to the plant-based might be an easier...
It's a great step in the right direction. Yeah, that's a way to transition, yes. So generally, I usually say try, you know, two or three dinners or two or three meals of the week using all plant food in the ingredients, including protein, and see what you like. And then whatever... you like, keep that as a regular and then experiment on three more in the following month.
So 6 weeks to 6 months, what's going on? It takes so long for your taste buds to adapt.
It depends upon historically what the taste buds have gotten used to. Mm-hmm. Imagine a growing little kid, always, you know, who drank high sugar soda, candies all the time, mm-hmm. never ate a carrot or a broccoli, right? That kid's taste buds, the threshold is set so high, the bar is set so high in the taste buds to send the signal to the brain that this is happy, mm-hmm. this is tasty, right? Because of the high saturated sugar, salt, and fat, which pushes the threshold up. For that kid, a strawberry is going to be tasting like a cardboard. Mm. And it is true. If the kid says that, oh, that's like a cardboard, that is exactly true. The kid is telling the truth. Physiology is that at that level threshold, even the strawberry cannot reach that threshold, right? So after a few weeks, you know, that threshold comes down, then the carrots and strawberries are going to taste better.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm trying to remember. It was a diet we did years ago, and I can't even remember what it was, but clearly it had to be less sodium because we did this, whatever, in a couple of weeks, whatever the diet was, and then I ate some goldfish, the goldfish crackers. I was, it tasted like pure salt.
Exactly.
And it was amazing the difference. So you can see where, you know, once you start cutting out like the salt or the sugar or the what have you, and then you go back and try it, you'd be like, whoa.
That becomes too much.
Yeah,
now. Yeah,
it's absolutely crazy. Yeah. What about the protein? A lot of folks, you know, talk about, you're on a plant-based diet. Where are you going to get your protein? And especially for kids, it's tough, right? So how do you, I have a kid who he will not eat beans unless they're jelly beans, right? So, and as much as I would love for him to eat beans, what are you looking for, especially when you're talking about kids, to make sure they get enough protein?
Yes. So protein can, for plant protein, it comes in the form of beans and lentils. It also is present in whole grains. And believe me or not, there is a protein in a medium-sized baked potato and broccoli and so forth.
Like broccoli,
different levels of protein, obviously,
yeah.
Right? So the way to think about adding protein for kids will be to see, you know, in what form or texture do they find that to be more acceptable, at least to begin with. So can it be, can there be some things that are added to a smoothie, for example, right? You know, adding some chia seeds, that brings in protein there, right? Or flax seeds. And also, can there be, you know, if there is a sandwich and there is a spread on it, can there be a spread that is made with, pesto that has edamame beans, which is a complete protein, right? So those kind of ways to think about creatively in how we can, in the kids' own, like sandwich or smoothie or whatever it is, like there are protein can be integrated in this forms.
Yeah, edamame is a good, he will eat, that's one
it's
he will eat.
It's a complete
eat.
Protein, yeah. And you can make a fantastic pesto with that.
Right.
And that, it can be a great way to add things.
Right. Emily writes, you mentioned chicken and dairy. What about seafood? Is a diet high in seafood increasing inflammation in the body and brain?
Correct. So with regard to how the body, the cells in the body react to protein, body doesn't differentiate the package in which the protein is coming when it comes to animal source proteins, right? Whether it is fish or chicken or red meat or dairy. Animal protein, the way it is made up, the building blocks that make up the protein called amino acids, they have a predominantly sulfur-containing building blocks that make up animal protein, and that seems to have more of a harmful than beneficial effect in the body, including inflammation and cancer risk as well. So, yeah, regardless of whether it is coming in the form of fish or chicken or red meat, the effect of animal protein is the same on the body.
Mm. All right. We have Brittany says, I consider myself a healthy eater, but I often wonder with regard to eating healthy foods to combat chronic disease, do you see a connection between choosing organic or non-organic produce and foods? Do you receive the same health benefits with non-organic foods, or do you see non-organic food as a potential health risk, such as how they may be treated with pesticides, etc.? Also, what are your thoughts on the research that has recently surfaced about alcohol's link to cancer and its effect on the growth of tumors? Would you recommend totally abstaining from alcohol given this research or continuing to consume alcohol in moderation? You sort of mentioned that your moderation, like very occasional with alcohol.
Very occasional. And if somebody already has a cancer, if you're a cancer survivor, I recommend zero alcohol.
Okay. And so what about the non-organic versus organic?
Yeah. So generally, the way I look at that is the best way to reduce the pesticide load, or if you're concerned about chemicals and pesticides coming through the food chain, is to eat at the lower end of the food chain, eat plants, regardless, eat plant-based foods, regardless of whether they are organic or not. In the first chapter, I explain it a lot, but the way to understand it is that, simply put, it takes 1,000 units of plants to support 100 units of herbivores, and it takes 100 units of the herbivores to support 10 units of carnivores on top. So if you think about it, it's like a pyramid, right? So that's how it works in science. It's due to physics. That's how it works. That's why you see in a landscape, if you see Nat Geo or Discovery Channel, you will always see two lions sitting, you know, watching 40 zebras in the middle of hundreds of thousands of plants, right? So lots of plants, some herbivores, two lines. That's how it's due to physics. That's how it works. So what that means is that all the pesticides and chemicals that were in the thousands of plants now end up in the 100 units of herbivores. And then all of that ends up in the 10 units of carnivores. So there's a concentration goes up of the pesticides when as you move up the food chain. So it's best to eat at the lower end of the food chain, eating plants, to reduce the load of pesticides, regardless whether it is organic or not. And then, you know, if you want to be more nuanced, you can always look at, there is a group called Environmental Working Group that publishes every few years something called Dirty Dozen and Clean 15. These are, they go into the shelves of the stores and they assess the level of pesticides and chemicals and they publish the Dirty Dozen, which is the most pesticide laden. So those kind of things, you can pick and choose as to which one you want to buy organic.
Yeah. Like, for example, strawberries. Look where they come, like, you know, an organic strawberry versus a strawberry that might come from another country. They may use more pesticides. So you want to look at
that. Yeah. I mean, there is also a cost issue there. Not everybody can afford it. So those are things to keep in mind. You know, whatever I'm saying cannot be applicable to everybody. So, so the simplest way, regardless of, you know, organic, the cost issues and all of that, if you choose to eat at the lower end of the food chain, eating plant-based foods automatically reduces pesticides and chemical load.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Kumara Siddhartha, Chief Health Equity and Wellness Officer at Cape Cod Healthcare. He's also the author of All My Secrets, Uncovering Messages of Health from Your Body. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, here's a question. What do you think about intermittent fasting for weight loss, like from 8 p.m. to 12 noon, for example?
The studies that looked at intermittent fasting, early studies showed benefit with regard to weight loss, and then later studies, more rigorous studies, showed mixed results. In other words, they didn't. So overall, it's not a slam dunk approach based on data. I would recommend. I think generally, fasting, what it does is it gives a break for the liver to recover. And it's almost like giving a vacation for the liver, right? It's nice because, you know, if you think about it on a daily basis, we eat, you know, people eat a lot of supplements and medications. And if you're not on medications, you're taking some supplements and vitamins. And if you're not on any of them, still the food that we eat, you know, if all the processed things, everything that has to be dealt with by the liver. Mm-hmm. Liver is the first stop that has to clean up everything. So fasting, at the least, what it does is it just gives a break for the liver to recover. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I call as detox. And there's a lot of these detox terms thrown around. To me, simply, what that means is that vacation for the liver. Yeah. So intermittent fasting in those strict guidelines of 8 to 4 p.m., those things, I think it's, the data is not very much, it's the data is mixed.
Yeah.
So I would say pay attention to your body. If you're hungry, eat food. If you're no longer hungry, stop eating food. Don't eat until you're full, like uncomfortably full.
Right.
So that kind of thing.
You know, you say pay attention to your body, and it's interesting. I have a niece who, she would get a lot of psoriasis on her head, and her doctor said, try a gluten-free diet. She did, and it went away. So now if she even has a little bit of gluten, she gets itchy. So it clearly made a difference. So I thought, you know, I want to try that. And I did a month of gluten-free. I didn't notice any difference at all. My body didn't, to me, I, you know, there was no difference.
Yeah. So the gluten-free diet is not applicable to for everybody. It's not something everybody has to try. It's only for those folks who have a sensitivity to
sensitivity,
it.
Sensitivity,
so
right.
In those individuals, if they have a medical condition like a skin condition or other joint issues, then for them it'll help. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Dan asks, is Dr. Sid even tempted by fast food? I'm going to guess no.
So no, I'm not, because I know so much about it. it's in my... It's yeah. wired right now.
There's a documentary with this guy who ate nothing but McDonald's for I don't remember how long it was. And boy, the changes in his body were not good. Very bad, right?
If I'm traveling on a highway, I usually have something with me. But if I don't, I figure out a way to pick and choose and wherever I'm stopping.
Right. Dr. Jane Ward's calling from Centerville. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy, and thank you so much for interviewing Dr. Siddhartha. Kumara, good morning.
Good morning, Jane.
I just can't say enough good things about his book and his teaching and his practice. I'm also a lifestyle medicine certified physician. I'm retired from the Air Force, and so most of the time I'm teaching. But honestly, what he's saying about this remarkable study for dementia is the same for many cancers, reversal of cancers, prostate cancer. In fact, Dr. Dean Ornish did the same, did the study that showed early prostate cancer could be reversed with a plant-based diet. It's the same for atrial fibrillation. I've just had a flare-up, and I've been reading a book by Dr. John Day from Utah, who's one of the leading electrophysiologist specialists in AFib in the country. And his whole book is basically the same story. Mm. It's lifestyle medicine. So I was very gratified that besides all the science, all the reports that I've been reading for the last, frankly, 12 years on this, the Air Force has embraced this. Mm. And I think that that may be something that would catch the attention of some of our listeners. Yeah. They now have a subspecialty within the medical service for not just physicians, but physicians, nurses, dietitians, exercise physiologists, behaviorists, and it's called lifestyle and performance medicine. Mm-hmm. They need to emphasize performance for the military because you want to keep the people, the force, yeah, as fit as possible, but they started with the elite forces, the special ops, because they're the elite athletes of the services, and they have embraced this, and they're changing the dining halls, they're changing the fast food franchises that are available on the base, they're eliminating some of them, and it's a remarkable turnaround in the last couple years. And in fact, last February 24, they actually held a three-day conference on this diet-centered lifestyle change. So kudos to you for interviewing Dr. Siddhartha. You should, you know.
Yeah, it's not our first time. We love having him in. He's very inspiring. Yeah, we all walk away.
And the book is fantastic. Yeah. I love your book because it really is sort of a manual for how do you take care of yourself without being told what to do.
All right. Dr. Ward, thanks for calling
in.
And appreciate
that. Thank you, Jane.
Thanks for calling in. We have an email from Richard, who this is a question I was going to ask you next, so this is perfect. He says, if you haven't already talked about this, could you speak to plant-based meat alternatives? And I was going to ask you, because if you go looking at the label and some of those that says plant-based meat, it's just a bunch of chemicals.
Yeah. So, yeah, they are processed. It's always good to read the labels and make sure that you recognize all the ingredients in them. And if there are different chemical names in them, they can be, rare, cultural events and things like that. You can maybe use them. Sometimes for some patients who struggle with transitioning from being on a real carnivorous diet to more plant-based diet, and they just, during the transition, just for the texture part, that I have used that as a temporary during the transition, mm-hmm, but it's not for long term, maybe just for like occasional events.
Yeah. All right. So what are your tips for how people can improve their ability to avoid temptation? You just talked about when you're on the road and you don't have something, but the idea is to plan, right? I mean, to think about.
Plan ahead, whatever is in front of us, we're going to eat it, right? What is easily accessible, we're going to do those behaviors. So making sure that the healthier options are more accessible, more in front of us, more easy to do is a good way to do it. Also make sure that we are building emotional memories with those healthier options, right? Mm-hmm. Like I have had patients who have struggled letting go of certain foods that may be unhealthy, but that's because that's the food they had with the grandma, right? Growing up. Or, those emotional
foods,
memories,
yeah,
those emotional experiences and memories go with that. It's very hard to let go of the food because it's association there. So why not build those experiences and healthy positive emotions, emotional memories now going forward with having a throwing a party with a whole food plant-based diet and having those, you know, friends and family and having those experiences, we're just going to build those memories going forward. And that helps as well. So yeah, practically making sure it's easier to do, and also making sure that you're just doing, having fun doing it.
Yeah. Here's a good question. This is from Tor. I know it's a hard sell in the industrialized West, especially in the U.S., but do you think commercial production of crickets for flour has a chance to catch on? Like bugs, yeah.
Yeah. That's a far stretch, I think, you know, in terms of looking at insects as protein source. We're not there at all. And I think right now, I don't know why we need to think about it, but really, there is so much complete protein that is available right where we are, and we can grow them. We don't need to think about, luckily, crickets.
All right. We sort of touched on the exercise piece of it, but just talk about the importance of exercise. We're talking about the plant-based diet, but exercise is also very important.
Yes, it is important. It's a great complementary addition to the food. But in generally, I would say that at least 3 days a week, bare minimum 30 minutes of aerobic activity, whether it's walking or running or movement, some kind of a movement that makes somebody sweat a little bit at the end of those 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's a brisk activity. 3 times a week, 30 minutes each is a bare minimum if we can hit it. Going beyond that is great, right? Mm-hmm. And not only that, it's not just about the aerobics. Having some amount of strength training that puts loads on the muscle, load on the bones, is going to be good for many reasons, including for how it changes the physiology in terms of diabetes and inflammation and reducing cancer risk. But it also is important to prevent falls, for example, right, that we talked about.
Yeah. All right. Linda's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Linda. Just a couple minutes. What's your question, Linda? Linda, are you there? All right. We don't have Linda. So Carol from Dennis says, what about pets? What should we feed them? I guess that's a question for the veterinarians.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I think I don't know which pets we're talking about here. There are different pets out there.
Yeah.
But if it's cats and dogs, they're omnivores.
Okay, yeah.
They're omnivores, to my knowledge.
All right. And then another big thing in like the last minute or so we have, belly laughs. It's good to laugh, right?
Yes. So belly laughs, you know, just scientifically, what it does is that you're moving the diaphragm. And when you move the diaphragm, you're moving something called a vagus nerve. A vagus nerve is a nerve that travels from the brain all the way down to the abdomen. And it goes through the diaphragm, which is like an umbrella separating the chest and the abdomen. And so anytime we stimulate the vagus nerve, it reduces the blood pressure. It reduces the pulse rate. It increases the oxygen in the blood. And it gives a sense of calm. So, in other words, like, you know, there are, you know, just belly laugh is one way, deep, you know, abdominal breathing that we do in a meditative yoga breathing, where you move the abdomen, you relax the abdomen, that also does the same thing.
All right. You've got some appearances coming up. You'll be in West Falmouth. Is it the West Falmouth Library? Is that where you're going to be?
It's
and
West
that's
Falmouth.
On the 11th at 1 o'clock. You're going to be at the Chatham Center for Spiritual Journey on the 16th at 1 o'clock, JFK Museum in Hyannis on the 24th at 10:30, and the Sandwich Public Library February 8th at 1:30. And we're going to post a link with more information about the appearances and your book at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Kumar Siddhartha is the Chief Health and Equity and Wellness Officer at Cape Cod Healthcare and author of All My Secrets, Uncovering Messages of Health from Your Body. Always great to have you here. We always walk away very inspired. I always stick with it, but I'm going to try again.
Thank you for having me, Mindy. It's always good to be here.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.